So why forgive is our topic for tonight. And one way of approaching it, I suppose, is to start with what everybody knows. And what everybody knows is that forgiveness is a good thing. Everybody knows this. Well, everybody also knows a lot of other things. And one of them could be summed up by a little piece of wisdom that I saw circulating on that source of all wisdom known as Facebook, which goes like this. Forgive, but remember the bastard's name. And probably most of us, and I'm not excluding myself, has some kind of balance or even conflict between these two things. And this balance or conflict is certainly one of the things that makes forgiveness rather difficult. Even though you want to, there may be something inside that doesn't want to let go. So let's look a little bit at some of these things and then move on perhaps to some reasons that forgiveness might not be a bad idea, hopefully beyond the obvious ones. Forgiveness is often taken to be a kind of condoning or enabling or putting up with someone else's bad behavior, right? If you forgive someone, it means often in your own mind that you're going to let them walk all over you. And there's naturally some resistance to this. And here's an interesting little fact about this, which is kind of a corollary, which is you think your grudges and your grievances are in some sort of way protecting you. This is the almost always unconscious thinking that goes on along these lines. If you don't hold these grudges and grievances, you will be defenseless, and a cruel, evil, nasty, harsh world will trample all over you and your nice new clothes. And then one of the things we need to look at is that, well, is that true or not? And I may get to that in a minute. Then, of course, there's a sense that, you know, it is, in fact, allowing someone else to do the same thing over again. And sometimes, I mean, you know, like in the traditional Christian teaching of forgive 70 times 70, there's often a little bit of a tone of that. And it makes one feel a bit weak, or be afraid that if you actually follow this, you will be a bit weak. Because the world doesn't like weakness, and it doesn't respect weakness. And it's not entirely 100% clear about what strength consists of. But sometimes strength consists of, we're told, this kind of hard, steely attitude toward the world that won't let anything in or anything out. I want to suggest at least a middle ground here. I agree that you can't let people walk all over you. I agree that if somebody swindles you, you have a right not to want to be swindled again. And you might well not want to go back to that car dealer or realtor or whoever it is that swindled you. That's fair. That's reasonable. But that's a rational decision that goes way past what we normally experience when something like that happens. There's that kind of sense of indignation of being taken advantage of that gnaws at you. You swear that you'll never let it happen again, that you'll protect yourself constantly with, you know, this forest of grievances that you're surrounding yourself with. Well, here is a possibility that all of these grudges and grievances that you're holding are not a source of strength, but are instead a source of weakness. What are they? Well, they are buttons, as in pushing buttons. If you have that kind of button installed in you, which is almost always self-installed, someone can find it and push it. Oh, by the way, everybody is incredibly obvious. Where your buttons are is incredibly obvious. Why don't we know this about other people? Because we're too involved in our own little worlds to actually see what's going on in any kind of clear way. You know, those stories about spiritual teachers who seem to have an almost clairvoyant sense of what's going on in a person or, you know, what's going on in their head. I want to suggest that at least in some cases, this may not be clairvoyance at all, but the fact that this person has freed himself or herself to some degree from the kind of games we play in our own heads, and therefore has a little bit more mental RAM space to see what's going on in everybody else's head. So if someone sees that in you and is kind of smart but not necessarily very moral, that can all be taken advantage of. And you know how this is done on a large scale, right? On individual cases, it might not be that easy to see, but on a mass level, it is. Because our grievances, our grudges, our resentments are the buttons, shall we say, that certain powers that be push to manipulate us. And an enormous amount of what constitutes political life and discourse in this country today is very much a question of pushing the buttons of people's grievances. And guess what? It really isn't so hard using this powerful weapon to get people to vote against their own self-interests, which people do all the time. All the time. I'm not going to get into a political discourse, and I'm certainly not going to take sides here, but it's quite obvious that this happens all the time, is happening now, and shows every sign of continuing to happen in the future. So, if you have all these grievances, they are weaknesses. They are points of weakness. One possible source of strength would be disconnecting these buttons as much as possible. Now, how is this done? Well, the simplest and easiest way is at least to become aware of them. Be aware of your weak points, your grudges, your grievances, collective and personal, and watch what happens when they're pushed. If you do this, you'll at least gain a certain amount of self-knowledge. But you might have a certain amount of inner freedom as well that actually gives you a choice of, rather than being, you know, an automatic android-like being who just kind of does what it's programmed to do, and a little bit more like a free human being who actually can choose. So that is a big advantage to letting all this stuff go. And another advantage, I would say, is emotional peace of mind. These grievances and grudges just are simply a torment, right? These things, you're going on and on about who did what to you, and I can't believe she did that then. And you know, I do it myself. I wouldn't be able to talk about it if I didn't. But I also realize at some point that it's really quite counterproductive. And it's just simply not going to save me anything. It's not going to help me in any kind of way. It's not going to help me see the world any more clearly. These are the things that veil the world from you, so to speak. You know, all the talk in spiritual literature about the veils of consciousness. Well, this is one of them. this kind of thing is one of them. I mean, it's not just some weird mystical stuff out in the astral stratosphere. It's, you know, one's own mental blocks and one's own personal hang-ups, as they used to say, and may still do. So letting go of all that has an enormous advantage, I would say. And when I talk about letting go in the sense of forgiveness, I mean just that. A lot of times, it's simply a matter of letting something drop, rather than some kind of blubbery reconciliation. In fact, there are few more obnoxious things to say under many circumstances than "I forgive you." Because it always, or very, very often, sounds incredibly sanctimonious, and it looks a bit like you are putting yourself on one level and forgiving this poor, wretched sinner on the other level, and the poor, wretched sinner, so designated, really isn't going to like that much. And you can get, you know, kind of huggy and kissy about it, but a certain amount of, a certain reek of insincerity follows the whole thing. So I'm not really big into the, you know, sometimes it happens. Sometimes, yeah, okay, it's fine. But I don't think that forgiveness means that you have to turn into Leo Buscaglia. Remember Leo Buscaglia? He, you know, he was this inspirational speaker. He was around in the 80s. I don't know, I think he must be dead now. But PBS used to have him on every pledge week. And, you know, he really laid it on thick. "I love you all so much. I wish I could give you my big zucchinis. My mama grew such big zucchinis. I love you all." People were blubbering and calling PBS and giving pledges, so it obviously worked. But, you know, this may not be quite the stance you want to take in life. So it doesn't always have to be that way. And a lot of times it's just simply a matter of just simply let it drop. And the dynamic of that is very interesting in a way, because letting it drop, well, is that easy? Sort of. But maybe not quite so easy as you think, or it may not be quite so automatic as you think. And this is part of the process that one has to be aware of, I suggest. What I'm talking about is something like this. You're holding a hammer, and I say drop the hammer. You don't really have to ask, how do I drop the hammer? How do I go about this dropping the hammer? You just drop it. And sometimes that works in the context of forgiveness. You just realize you're holding on to something you don't want and you let it go. But granted, I'm willing to admit, and I certainly experience it for myself, this is not always that simple. Try this. Clench your fists tightly. Let's see, keep clenching, maybe tighter. You've now been doing it for a staggering 10 seconds. All right, loosen it. It doesn't always open automatically. I'm not holding it shut anymore. I'm not, at this point, making any effort to keep the fist clenched. Nonetheless, it's not coming out on its own. So sometimes letting it drop is a matter of a process, and sometimes it's a matter of a process that takes time. And I think it's very important to be realistic with oneself about it. Another major point is that while, as I think I've attempted to persuade you, forgiveness is a good thing, honesty with yourself is a much better thing. And you are not really going to get very far. I'm not going to get very far if I pretend I've forgiven when I haven't, to myself, right? In terms of how you behave toward other people, well, that's another story, because, of course, all human interaction is heavily layered with certain amounts of insincerity. And if this, you may think this is funny, you may think it's sad, you may think it's infuriating, but these layers of insincerity are pretty much kind of like the cement that holds society together. As you know, simply the question is like just exactly when and how many times you should tell the truth. Do you like my dress? How is that pie I made last night? You know, the truth is not always the absolute perfect thing to say in a perfectly complete and forthright way. And we all know this. We're not talking about active lying, but yeah, there's always, well, that dress is, yeah, it's nice. Nice. So we do that with other people, and we're expected to. And this is not going to change anytime soon, because I don't think it's ever been any different in the past throughout all of what is known about human history. But it's good to be honest with yourself. And there's a big difference in my mind between, yeah, I've forgiven this person when emotionally you've done nothing of the kind, and saying, no, I haven't forgiven this person, not in the slightest. You may take it a step further and say, well, my upset with this person is not really doing me much good, as I was saying earlier. I may, in principle, want to forgive, and it might even be kind of an act of intention. I may not be able to fully, to, shall we say, open my fist now, but you know, I may have an intention to kind of let it open in some kind of more natural way, so that you are not punishing yourself for not being able to forgive. Needless to say, or no, I guess it is needful to say, forgiveness has to include oneself. If you're, you know, incredibly harsh with yourself, as opposed to at least cutting yourself a little bit of slack, well, that is a recipe for unhappiness. So, all right, sometimes the best you're going to do is I forgive myself for not being able to forgive. Maybe in the long run I'll be able to, but right now it's just not the way it is. And you'll also notice something rather curious, that people's grudges are only kind of approximately connected to the size of the actual offense. Sometimes people, I mean, I've certainly done this myself. Sometimes people will be able to let a fairly major slight go, but be furious at someone for not, you know, sending a Christmas card or returning a phone call. Why is this? Well, as you all know, the human mind is not completely rational. So that's another thing to be aware of as well, I would suggest. So forgiveness can be seen as kind of an ongoing inner process, an ongoing thing that you work with. You may have really major issues. I mean, if you have some really heavy thing in your background, like childhood abuse or something like that, well, yeah, it's not quite like forgiving someone for failing to send a Christmas card. That's, you know, there's going to be a difference. And usually if there's some like major trauma involved of that kind, you probably at some point or another will need professional help just to, you know, kind of get, sort out your own feelings about it and let it go. But I've noticed an interesting thing to bring up the unpleasant subject of rape and rape victims, with whom I and I have no firsthand experience of this, knock on wood, but you know, when I kind of read or hear about rape victims, there seem to be two types. One is someone who's completely broken by it. And another type of person who says, you know, yeah, that was really awful, that was really bad, but I no doubt about it, it was a terrible thing that happened to me, but I have a life and I've got to go on and lead my life. It would seem that the second response is healthier and more productive. You're not letting it go to be a nice person or because Mr. Jesus in the Bible says you ought to. You're doing it because you have a life that you want to continue having and you don't want it submerged in this event in the past. As I say, some people do, often, usually do need some kind of professional help or guidance in sorting through it. But in the end, I think you can say letting it go in that sort of way is more or less the same as forgiveness. You know, you're letting it go. How far you go with it, well, it's obviously a matter of personal characteristics. So up to now, we've been talking about grudges and grievances and forgiveness in a more or less personal way. What has been done to me personally. And as difficult as this can be to forgive in this kind of context, people often have much more difficulty with forgiving larger things that actually have nothing to do with them. The first time I gave a presentation like this, which by some peculiar coincidence was in this very room, you know, someone raised her hand and said, you know, I can forgive the things in my own life, but what about the big things, you know, the great crimes and atrocities in history? What about those? I have real trouble forgiving those. There are a couple of things one should note about this. One, most of these monsters of history are gone. They're not around anymore. They're not around to be affected by your forgiveness, your grudges, and you're being one of the tens of millions of voices to say that they were bad people and they did bad things really doesn't add much to it. I'm not even going to name specific examples because some of these names are like, some of these names are buttons in their own right. You fill in your own names if you like, but yeah, they're gone. There's nothing your forgiveness is going to do to them. No one's saying that it wasn't bad or it should, you know, it was really all right or whatever. No one is making it, but, you know, to kind of go on with kind of this indignation about it, is also kind of counterproductive for oneself emotionally. As for the injustices that are going on now, what I'm about to tell you may itself be worth the price of admission. You are not going to do anything about the vast majority of things in the world today. You are not going to do a single damn thing. And you know it, and I know it. Why? Well, one thing, no one can. No one can take effective action on X, Y, and Z. You may want to sometimes feel like you're taking effective action by signing a petition that nobody's going to read anyway. And, you know, I do that sort of thing myself as a, I call it a sop to my conscience. You know, it's probably harmless. But to really affect things is quite a big task. And even to affect things in a little way is quite a big task. The story occurs to me. I have a friend who is or was very, very well connected in the Tennessee Republican Party. And about 10 years ago or more, 12 years ago, I suppose, he really did not think that Mr. Bush's idea of invading Iraq was a very good one. So he decided he was going to do everything he could to fight it. And he did. He saw everybody he knew. He saw everybody that the people he knew saw. He, as they say, squandered all his political capital. Nothing came of it. And I'm talking about someone with actual real influence and connections. In the end, well, as I suppose you know, the United States did go to war with Iraq. And my friend got fed up with politics and never wanted to bother with it again. So another valuable piece of information I'd like to offer to you is that a wise man never undertakes actions that he knows to be futile. This is not to say that you're powerless in the world, but the only people who affect anything at all, the only people who do make any sort of change at all, tend to have one thing in common. There's one thing they're working on. They know this well, whether it's environmental or social justice or hunger or, you know, blindness in third world countries or whatever. People take on, like Princess Diana, remember her? She made it a big cause of hers to have the enormous number of landmines that are still sitting around unexploded in the world dug up, and this was her cause. This is what she did. And I guess they dug up a lot of landmines because of Princess Diana's efforts. If she had done, you know, if she just tried to do 20 or 30 different things, nothing would have happened. So if you're talking about effective action in the world, effective action means targeted, focused action. Obviously, what your role is, what you should do in the world, what your, as I call it in the book, your special function may be, you know, no one else is going to be able to tell that. And, you know, you're lucky if you can tell it for yourself. But I would say that that's a much more effective way of doing positive action in the world rather than, you know, upsetting yourself about all the bad things. There's another problem with that, this aspect of it. It's what I call the entertainment of conscience. As you know, you can go just about anywhere in this great country of ours and see enormous widescreen TVs. I mean, they're in elevators now. There's even the gas station TV network, which usually is pretty innocuous. But you know, all this stuff, and of course the news is almost all, not only bad, but it's the most, you know, here are the five worst things that happened today to anybody that we could find, so here they are for your pleasure. So why do we do this? I mean, there is the unfortunate fact that there is something in human nature that likes to watch violence and suffering. This is an ugly fact. You know, the Romans knew it because they literally had people kill each other. You know, we're more sophisticated about it now, and it's brought to us under the guise of news. But you have to wonder about that. The other thing is getting upset about all of that stuff. You know, particularly in the news watching. It does feed something I think that's a bit unwholesome, which is the reasoning goes something like this. Again, unconsciously, if I get upset about all these terrible things that happen in the world, this must make me a good person. Well, as a matter of fact, it really doesn't. Why? Because it doesn't really do much anyone good. A good person helps other people. A good, you know, a good person doesn't, you know, feel guilty because, you know, he isn't doing anything. Guilt doesn't make you a good person. What makes you a good person? Doing things that actually help people, actually behaving kindly and decently. That makes you a good person. Feeling bad because bad things are happening in the world is really quite irrelevant. So that's, you know, so how do you, that's how you forgive the big things. You know, you take action. In my view, I would say you take action where you can. You know, in a sense, what your work is in the world. And I'd be the first to admit that that is not an easy thing to figure out. And secondly, well, it's probably not a good idea to indulge too much in this kind of lamentation about the way things are. And a lot of it is quite habitual. A lot of people do it simply because they don't know any better. Like during the Gulf War in the 90s, I had a friend who said, I'm really getting upset by watching all this stuff about the war. And I said, well, why don't you stop watching it? She said, I never thought of that. So I think this is all kind of bundled in with forgiveness because letting go a lot of this internal torment, which is, in a sense, the opposite of forgiveness, is a source of much personal unhappiness. But let's go to a bit more of the more metaphysical side of it all. Why should you forgive? Forgiveness is not it's not as universal a value or virtue as one might think. And it's actually fairly recently in human history that it's even been kind of held up as a value. In the West, the first person to kind of practice it in a major way was Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar was one of the two leading opponents in the Roman Civil War. And Julius Caesar won, which is why you've heard his name, and why you may not have heard of Cnaeus Pompey, who was the loser. Well, Julius Caesar got himself elected dictator of Rome for life. That was actually the title he got. And he did an amazing thing. Instead of an enormous bloodbath of his enemies, which is what they usually did after such things, he just let them go. He forgave them. And I guess I wouldn't be totally honest if I didn't have to point out to you that 2 years later they thanked him for this by stabbing him to death in the Senate, but nonetheless. One person who was actually very impressed by Caesar's behavior was a guy who had actually been on the other side, which is the Roman orator and philosopher Cicero. And Cicero, who was at the end of his life at that point, was writing mostly philosophical works, has in his philosophical works praise of forgiveness as a virtue. And that is kind of where it started to leak into the Western world at large. Certainly Christianity and the teachings of Jesus were another major step in it. And forgiveness is not, for example, in the Hebrew Bible, forgiveness is not a huge value either. Almost all the times in the Hebrew Bible when there's a talk about forgiveness, it is somebody asking God for forgiveness. Very rarely is it a matter of one person forgiving another. It's like, I've sinned against you, oh God. You know, they're killing all our people and burning down the temple, so I'm really sorry. I hope you forgive us and maybe stop this. That kind of forgiveness as a personal ethical value really came with Christianity. And is it a spiritual, what good is it, in a sense, beyond all of what I've been telling you? Well, let's look at it from a slightly different angle. Everybody here has heard the line, I will give it to you in the correct translation of the Greek of the New Testament. The literal correct translation of this line is, forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors. Not as we forgive, and it's not trespass, it is debts. The word is debts. And talking about forgiving debts, even in an economic way, you know, could be a quite large subject, and you know, we may go there or we may not. Forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors. Right, you have to do the forgiving first. It's not like it says in church, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. It's not like, you know, some hostage exchange, you know, among thugs or something like that, right? You do the forgiving first. Well, why is it a good idea? Well, let's look at it from the point of view of theosophy, the teaching that kind of made this premises and sort of brought us all together. One of the things that theosophy did most strikingly was it introduced the concept of karma to the Western world. Now karma is part of everyday language. My friends in San Francisco somewhat inaccurately used to say a person had parking karma if they had good luck finding a space. You know, it meant kind of like good karma, probably by some unconscious association with the word charm. But karma is typically defined as the law of cause and effect, except that's not quite 100% complete. It is not saying that a cause has an effect, which is what Western science says. We don't know, a cause has an effect, we don't know what it is, let's find it out. That's Western science. The law of karma as a law of cause and effect is that a cause has an effect like itself. In a sense, the law is saying we already know what kind of effect a cause is going to have, where Western science is a little bit more, shall we say, agnostic about it. I've often wondered if that isn't why science developed in the West and not in the East, but it would take a lifetime of study to actually figure out the answer to that question. In any case, karma. Well, karma is an impersonal law. Particularly in the Eastern tradition, it's an impersonal law. It is the way things are. It's like the second law of thermodynamics, and I hope you won't ask me what the second law of thermodynamics is. But you know, it's just a natural law. This is the way it is. There's no Mr. God up there, disposing all of this. It's just the way it is. You do something bad is going to happen to you. This has caught on so enormously well in the West because what Christianity turned into, where you suffer an infinite amount in hell for what, at the very, very worst, is a few decades of things, however bad. You have a finite group of sins, but infinite punishment. There's no real justice in that I can see. Whereas the law of karma is saying, well, you did this will come back to you. So there is a certain, it has a sense of innate kind of cosmic fairness about it that Christianity, as it is now known, doesn't. But the good side of it is that. The bad side is, of course, it is inexorable. You know, you did this, this is going to happen. You know, the language of the Bible, they who sow the wind shall reap the whirlwind. You know, you throw it out, it's going to come back to you. And, you know, this is, as I say, it's more pleasant than the thought of frying in hell for eternity, but it has its own bleakness about it, too. It's, you know, it's just, there's no way out of it. Eastern traditions, as I understand them, are away, all an attempt to get out of the wheel of karma. But, so is there any way of sort of short-circuiting this process? Well, I would say that Christianity did, or Christ, or Jesus, whatever you like, did actually hit upon it. He did hit upon an out in the law of karma. Well, I've already said it. Forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors. If this law of karma is inexorable, if you get what you put out, the only way you're gonna escape the consequences of your little misdeeds is through forgiveness. Because by the law of karma, if you forgive, you're entitled to forgiveness. Just the way, you know, if you kill someone, you're going to get killed yourself in this life or another. And I think that was, a brilliant, shall we say, if Jesus was actually saying that, and what Jesus was saying is, I gave a talk on that a few months ago, and it's a long subject in its own right. But it is an interesting out. And this is actually this is a really good reason to forgive. And most of us, I would say even most people who never even have thought about Eastern spirituality or theosophy or whatever, do believe in the law of karma. There's a sense, kind of a natural justice in the world that, it's going to come back to you. And it may be that we have this strong intuitive feeling, largely because that's the way things are. We thirst for cosmic justice, right? It's a real thirst. People want the cosmos to be just. Well, maybe that's because there is such a thing as cosmic justice. Would you want it if it didn't exist? Would you ever feel thirsty if there was no such thing as water? So maybe there is this cosmic justice, and this is a way of, shall we say, applying it or leveraging it for your own best advantage.
Richard, how do we know when we've done enough for the forgiveness? Some people, if an eye for an eye, and they're fine. But if you're on the spiritual path, and they talk about the goal is freedom and stuff like that, and how do you know when you've actually done enough? Do you no longer have the bad feelings, or how do you know when you can just move on to something else?
Well, how do you know you're better? You've recovered from an illness. It doesn't hurt anymore. There's a point where it just not a problem anymore. And to go back to something I was saying earlier, like everything, forgiveness is an art. And an art involves a judicious application of effort and non-effort, shall we say. If you do something too hard, it's as bad as not doing it all often. So there's a certain kind of artistry in that, and as I tried to say earlier, that a lot of that artistry is being forgiving with yourself. All right, this is as far as I am. I'm upset about this with this person. This is as far as I am right now, because as I say, honesty is a much more important virtue still, or particularly self-honesty, because without telling the truth to yourself, you're not going to get anywhere. That's as far as I can go right now. Okay, that's as far as I can go. I'm at least willing to accept the possibility that it can go further, and I'm willing to allow it to go further, naturally. I broke my leg. I can walk a couple of steps now that my leg has been set and it's healing a little bit, but I can't really go any further. Give it a little time, eventually everything is back to normal. So that's what I would say.
Yeah, when it comes to forgiving, the most important point to me is that whatever happened, learning a lesson from it and become alert to the situation and then move on. Otherwise, if by getting emotionally, disturbed inside, mm-hmm. that means it generates the anger inside me. Mm-hmm. So I am being punished than the other person. So the in a spiritual sense, the anger is the one which is it's eating me up. Mm-hmm. For my own sake. Mm-hmm. Forgiving it does more good to the person, because while I am being angry and getting disturbed for a long time, while the other person who did the harm may be doing fine. So for my own sake, forgiving makes more sense in a spiritual sense, but in a logical, societal way, it makes me angry because justice is not done. So there are two levels we can see, is that in a social and personal way, I want to get even with the person, but in a spiritual way, by being me angry about that for a long time, actually it's like acid inside me burning myself. So for my own sake, for my own well-being, forgiving after a certain amount of processing makes sense, you know, to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are all very good points. I mean, you know, as human beings as we are now, there are a lot of things going on at different levels simultaneously. You know, there is one sense that, you know, this anger isn't doing me any good. There's another sense where I, you know, just really want to get back at him. And at the very least, this sets up profound inner conflict. And our minds are, as presently constituted, complex, but not, shall we say, perfectly integrated. So one half wants to do this, one half wants to do something else. And one way of integrating that is, in a sense, trying to see both things at the same time. Why does that help? Because at the very least, it gives you the possibility of rising to a higher level from which you can see both of these, you know, and that in itself, you know, I wouldn't say it's enlightenment, but I think it's kind of a type of enlightenment or something on the way to enlightenment. But again, yeah, you just, you know, one has to be frank about it. The other thing is, you know, the law of retaliation has been the law of human history ever for a long, long time. Like, one of the most famous turning points in Western history is there's the Oresteia of Aeschylus, which is a trilogy of three tragedies written, produced in 458 BC, if I remember correctly. And what happens is Orestes' mother kills his father. So he's supposed to kill her, which he does. But then, of course, so the Furies that are nursed on the blood of her mother come and torment him. And in the end, the gods come down and sort it all out by instituting a kind of rule of law. And so the rule of law, as we now know it, you know, takes the place of the law of revenge. If someone is murdered in this country, the victim's family is not supposed to retaliate. It's against the law to retaliate. But there's still many parts of the world in which, yes, you are supposed to retaliate. You're a bad person if you don't go out, right? Well, that's just the way it is there. But the whole point of it is that, yeah, that whole law of vengeance, the lex talionis, as it's called, that's probably the way it was until 458 BC. So, you know, and that's in us. It's in our natures. It's in our genes, if you like. And that's just a fact, I think, that has to be acknowledged.
From someone through the internet, how do you forgive yourself? Sometimes we are so mad at someone for doing something painful to us, but we allow them to do it.
Well, the easiest route to that is by casting it in slightly different terms. Rather than regarding it as an offense against yourself, so a bad thing you did to yourself, It becomes much easier to let go of if you cast it in terms of a mistake. I made a mistake. I let this person do that to me. It wasn't good, because we're not trying to lie to ourselves. It wasn't good. Yeah, I shouldn't have done it, but I'm not going to make life any worse for myself by beating myself up about it. I'm not going to let that person do that to me again. I'm not going to let myself be walked over in similar circumstances later. So this was a mistake. I learned from it. I think that's a healthier and more promising approach than either beating yourself up about it or what is this as bad or as worse? Hey, you're beating yourself up because you let someone do this to you. Oh, you've just made the problem worse because now you're beating yourself up because you can't forgive yourself for letting this person do this to you. So you've just added a whole other dimension of guilt and suffering for yourself. And of course, the objective is to remove dimensions and layers of guilt and suffering for yourself rather than add on to them. And a lot of this stuff, if you're kind of aware of it, it becomes much easier to deal with. It reminds me of a woman I know years ago who had a dog that was barking too much, and she had to teach it to stop barking. And what she said to me was, well, the first thing you do to teach a dog to stop barking is to teach it that it's barking. I guess. A dog can be aware that it's barking or not aware that it's barking, and she anyway thought so, and that was her approach to it. So in terms of our own psyches, being aware that you're barking, so to speak, is a very good, shall we say, opening salvo.
Sometimes the first step towards forgiveness is realizing the other person was born an idiot. There was no question mark.
Well, I guess you all know that as we all make our way or stumble our way through lives, you're going to meet a lot of different people. And yes, some of them are idiots, or seem indistinguishable from idiots to all external appearances. So yeah, that's what are you going to do? This but it's a joke, sort of. But in another way, it's not, because there are situations you realize this person is simply not capable of doing anything any better. This person is simply, that is simply the way the person is. I have no reason to expect this person to improve. Often they can kind of guess, why this person might be that way. But of course, you're not going to change it. Whether they're that way because they're stupid. And Here's a fascinating fact. Do you know that half the U.S. population are of below average intelligence? Well, that's true, right? It's true by definition. You're going to meet some of these people. I'm sure you often felt as if you have. And that's part of life. There's a funny saying, and I don't know how it really was intended, but it's a Sufi saying. And I imagine it has meaning in a lot of different dimensions, but it says, there is no God but reality. To seek him elsewhere is the action of the fall. And I could see where you get very theological about it, but some of it is, this is reality. Why is it the way it is? Well, we don't entirely know 100%, but it is. And this reality is deeply and intimately bound up with two little things known as good and evil, all of which we experience in our lives to some degree or another. There's no one here, no one anywhere, who hasn't experienced some evil or some good in their lives. The proportions vary wildly for reasons that it would take another lecture to sort out, and even then, we might not come to any helpful answer. Harm is, you know, certainly one of them. So, but anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Richard. As always, a very thought-provoking lecture. I just wanted to share something from my native country. It's a popular saying, but I think it is quite profound, and it came to my mind right now. It translates into something like this: to understand it all is to forgive it all. And I have always carried with me, and that makes me measure my level of ignorance or spirituality when I get caught up in the mundane stuff. But it is quite profound. Perhaps you can relate to this very well, as you have spoken in your lecture. So I just wanted to hear that.
You hear it sometimes in French, to comprendre, c'est tout pardonner. I often see it in French. It just means what she just said it meant. So, but it's very true. You know, if you really saw, you know, what this person, you know, did or, you know, had happened to him, who knows? And, you know, sometimes you really wonder. I went to a wedding in October up in Madison, and the justice of the peace turned out to be an appellate judge. And I was talking to him before the wedding and just making idle conversation. I said, well, you're an appellate judge. That must you must see a lot of strange slices of life. And he said, yeah. A lot of childhood sexual abuse. I don't know. That was the thing that came to his mind. I have no reason to think he's wrong. So who knows what people have gone through? I mean, you know, I think in my past I've been fairly fortunate, so I don't really have any complaints. But, you know, sometimes, or you might know someone who has a couple of stories to tell. So, yeah, that. You know, if you really understood it all, if you really understood what this person had been through and what kind of made him or her into that, yeah, it would be probably easier, would be easier to forgive.
One more question from someone watching through the internet. You spoke of the veils of consciousness. Is forgiveness an energy force that can overcome or strip away the veil of consciousness? A veil of consciousness, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have all heard this saying, we are one, we are all one, right? Well, there's nothing self-evidently true about this, right? You know, because no, I mean, I have a body here. You have a body sitting there. We won. In what kind of sense are we one? You know, you got the job. I didn't. You know, what way are we one? That, at least according to some teachings, is a veil. These physical forms are a veil that mask kind of an deeper underlying unity. So you could argue that forgiveness is a way of weakening the hold of one's belief in this one level of reality as the only level of reality and moving a little further ahead.
It's not really a question, but your talk brought to mind, I have a Quaker friend in New Hampshire who's very active in an organization called the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And to me, the work that these people do with people who have perhaps murdered someone in their family or whatever is such an incredible role model and example of forgiveness and the whole reconciliation piece of it. And I mean, that kind of work gets done in countries too. South Africa for what comes to mind, where people are actually reconciled with those who perhaps tortured or murdered family members. And so when I think about my own grievances in in light of this larger larger picture, it helps me, I think, to move forward and, mm-hmm. and not get so wrapped up in my own mm-hmm. pettiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to look at it, you know, what could be more real than realpolitik, you know, the world of politics and relations. And before apartheid ended, as you may remember, pretty much everyone was expecting that when it did end, there was just going to be a bloodbath. That was just, you know, and of course, that's one reason they didn't want to end it, because they were terrified. And because of Mandela and his Truth and Reconciliation councils, South Africa is not exactly, you know, a perfect society today, but the bloodbath never happened. So, you know, you really have to, and another example is the World Wars. World War I. World War I, Germany lost. And the Allies decided they were really going to punish Germany and make them give up territory and pay some staggering amount in reparations. And this worked so incredibly well that 20 years later, a newer, stronger, and meaner Germany started World War II. This time it was different, because the winners, you know, mostly in this case the Americans and the British, decided instead of punishing these countries, who had a pretty pretty high stack of atrocities racked up to their name, they decided to forget, and they rebuilt those countries. And, you know, there are a lot of threats to peace in the world, but quite frankly, Germany and Japan are not very high among them. So, you know, even in terms of politics, I mean, nothing is more real than this, right? What's more real than two world wars? Even in that context, forgiveness actually turns out to be, you know, a matter of good policy. Now, people will say that, you know, maybe the United States did this out of self-interest. Well, very well, but one of the themes that I've been trying to pursue this evening is that, yeah, forgiveness is a matter of self-interest, many different ways.